sharply to 30 this week, and it has created huge concerns.
A sharp spike in COVID-19 cases in India causing new worries. It's Friday, March 6th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Doug Bernard in Washington. Join us live on Facebook. Also ahead, the coronavirus shows no sign of stopping. Israel fails again to form a government. And resurrecting the Holy Grail from the Titanic. It's all ahead on today's VOA Asia. Our top story today is the COVID-19 outbreak. In France, cases jumped by 92 on Thursday to 377 total. There have also been two more deaths, bringing the national total to 6. Here's journalist Nicolas Pinot in Paris.
French authorities, they're trying to reassure people, trying to reassure the population that everything is under control. But as of right now, they're not going to close any school or colleges like they did in Italy. And the main concern right now, there is a huge political event in France next week, elections for city hall, for mayors. So far, authorities, they have been saying this election will take place in France.
That was journalist Nicolas Pinot in Paris. And South Africa has announced its first confirmed case of the new coronavirus. Health Minister Zwelithini Mkhize said the 38-year-old man from KwaZulu-Natal province has returned this week from Italy with his wife and other travelers. A health team is now getting in touch with all the people he had contact with. South Africa is the first Southern African country and the third in sub-Saharan Africa to register a case of the new coronavirus. To date, 7 countries in Africa have recorded cases: Algeria, Senegal, Egypt, Nigeria, Morocco, Tunisia, and South Africa. Briefing South African's parliament in Cape Town on the case Thursday, the health minister said the man is being treated and is in isolation.
I was informed this morning, I've already briefed the president, this is a person who had traveled to Italy, and they were a group of 10, and so they returned a few days ago. But the patient had consulted a general practitioner who was, because of the level of collaboration, was aware of the protocol that we have to take. Patient had presented with fever, headaches, malaise, and sore throat, not much of a cough. And in the process, they took the specimen, and then they got the laboratory informed. And this has been tested positive.
Healthcare workers are on the front lines of fighting COVID-19. But how can they stay safe? University of Minnesota Duluth professor Dr. Jeremy Ude explains how to VOA's Jason Patinkin.
Healthcare workers are on the front line, and that makes them particularly vulnerable to contracting these sorts of infectious diseases. This is part of the reason why it's so important that people not panic by, say, going out and buying up all sorts of masks, because that limits the availability of those respiratory masks for healthcare workers who actually would benefit from being able to have access to them. So a lot of it is about just making sure that there are these sorts of facilities available, these sorts of containment measures, and these sorts of protection materials available for healthcare workers. And that may also involve cooperating across different state lines or even across national lines so that supplies can get to those areas where they are most needed. If and when there are these outbreaks among healthcare workers, this is where I think it's going to be really important to see where there can be opportunities for cooperation, not just between healthcare facilities, but also, say, working with non-governmental organizations or other groups that may have some expertise that can go in and can help to augment those healthcare workers and make sure that care can still be provided in those communities. The last thing that I think is absolutely vital, though, is paying attention to the healthcare workers, making sure that their voices are being heard and that their concerns are being listened to. They can be really effective advocates for themselves about what sorts of supplies they need, what sorts of resources are necessary for them to be able to do their jobs. When we've seen healthcare workers feel like their voices haven't been heard or that government officials aren't paying attention to them, we've seen healthcare workers say, well, I'm not going to work then. I'm not going to put myself and potentially my family at risk. And that just exacerbates these sorts of outbreaks.
And that was something that happened early on in this outbreak in Hong Kong, where for a period of time, a number of doctors downed their tools because they felt the Hong Kong government wasn't restricting travel enough from China.
Right. And again, if this is where that communication and that trust becomes so important, that there's a good line of communication between those frontline healthcare workers and the policymakers who are making these decisions, but also that both sides feel like they can trust each other and that their voices are going to be heard and that they can then implement policies that are going to be rational and effective and have buy-in from various communities.
Last of all, you talk about this need for trust and also for these different organizations to be working together. Now that this is quite clearly a global outbreak, how do you think the global community is doing in terms of coordinating? Obviously, there's the WHO, then there are plenty of other national organizations as well as non-governmental organizations. Are you seeing right now the kind of level of global coordination that is needed to bring this under control?
In the early days, the international community kind of missed a step. They missed an opportunity to really get on this as quickly as they could. In more recent days, I think we have seen WHO and other organizations taking a more active and aggressive approach. You know, WHO is limited in terms of what it's able to do. It's not able to actually deploy a lot of healthcare workers itself, but it can provide this really important repository of information, sharing and disseminating that information, and bringing together these different parties so that we all have a common set of knowledge that we can use to build policy. So I think things are starting to move in the right direction, but that doesn't mean that we can just rest on our laurels. It doesn't mean that everything is fine. And we have seen some disagreements among various national governments about their willingness to share information or to cooperate with other countries. And the important thing with an outbreak like this that is clearly on a worldwide scale is that no country is going to be able to handle it on its own. Even if a country is doing everything that it thinks is going to be effective within its own borders, what we've seen very clearly is that it only takes one or two people who may have traveled to another country and inadvertently bring the virus back with them, and you can have another flare-up happening in that country. So there has to be this global cooperation that has to be at the forefront.
That was Jeremy Ude of the University of Minnesota Duluth explaining to VOA's Jason Patinkin the necessary needs of healthcare workers. And this reminder that we have an entire section on the coronavirus on our website. It's all at voanews.com. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on voanews.com. Pet cats and dogs cannot pass the coronavirus onto humans, but they can test positive for low levels of the pathogen if they catch it from their owners. The International Criminal Court has ruled that an investigation can go ahead into war crimes allegedly committed by the United States in the conflict in Afghanistan. And Australia has confirmed its second death from the coronavirus. The latest victim is a 95-year-old woman who died at a nursing home in Sydney. You can read and watch much more at VOA Asia Facebook and Twitter, plus our website, voanews.com. VOA Asia continues. While reports from places where coronavirus has spread show images of people wearing surgical masks, health experts say they're really not the most effective protection against the spread. As Bronwyn Benito reports, there are other, more effective ways to protect yourself and others from contamination.
As coronavirus continues to spread, people are rushing to buy protective masks, and supply can't keep up with the demand. That is worrying public health agencies.
I do understand why so many people are lining up to get masks, but we also don't want to run out of masks for our healthcare providers, because that will be a really serious problem for our entire healthcare system.
There's no role for these masks in the community. These masks need to be prioritized for healthcare professionals that, as part of their job, are taking care of individuals and or individuals who have this virus and are in home isolation, a home quarantine for those family members.
And wearing them will not necessarily prevent contamination.
If you're the one wearing the mask, you probably are getting a false sense of security.
That's because viruses land on things you touch throughout the day. Railings, seats, doorknobs, money.
But things that we can do to protect ourselves is wash our hands a lot, try not to touch our face, elbow bump instead of shaking hands. But also, don't sit in an environment with poor ventilation with somebody who's sick.
Like cars and cabs.
If you're sitting in a car and it's on recirc, you are rebreathing your breath and that of everybody else in the car.
Milton says this means an infected person should be wearing a mask to keep from releasing the virus into the air in respiratory droplets.
Droplets that flew from your nose or mouth to someone else's.
All of this is why the National Institutes of Health and the Centers for Disease Control say following simple rules can help curb the spread of the virus.
Everyday measures like covering your cough or sneeze, staying home when you're sick, are very important. And, of course, the evergreen, wash your hands.
So hashtag cover your mouth. And don't forget to
wash your hands and elbow bump and put a surgical mask on the sick person.
Bronwyn Benito, VOA News, Washington.
Happening now in Asia, a recent publication by an Al-Qaeda militant group about a retired Pakistani three-star general joining its ranks has renewed debate about the influence of Islamist militants in the country's military. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. And we're happy you're with us on VOA Asia. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is struggling to build a governing coalition, even after beating challenger former Chief of Staff Benny Gantz in Monday's elections, the country's third in a year. Netanyahu, Israel's longest-serving prime minister, has fallen only 3 seats short of forming a government coalition.
Exit polls on Monday night had originally given Mr. Netanyahu's right-wing and religious bloc 60 seats out of the 120 seats in the Knesset, Israel's parliament. But final results changed the picture. In many ways, it is similar to the 2 previous elections this year, with no party having a way to form a majority coalition. Mr. Netanyahu did bounce back from the last election, with his Likud party becoming the largest, and Israel's President Reuven Rivlin is expected to offer him the first chance to form a government. Mr. Netanyahu insisted he had won big, despite 3 indictments on corruption charges. His trial is scheduled to start on March 17th. He said that Israelis gave him more votes for prime minister than anyone in Israel's history. And that, he said, was a knockout. Mr. Netanyahu also accused Benny Gantz of trying to undermine the results of the election by pushing forward a law that would make it illegal for a prime minister to continue to serve while under indictment. Analysts say it will not be easy to pass that law quickly, and it is not likely to affect the prime minister now. Israeli journalist Amos Asael says Mr. Netanyahu won, but still has a long road ahead of him.
This is not a landslide, and this does not automatically and sweepingly, as they currently suggest, this does not automatically give them the kind of solid government that they must be able to produce in order to finally put an end to the political stalemate that we've had here for a year.
Mr. Netanyahu has to try to get at least 3 members of the center-left bloc to change sides and support his government. Gael Tal-Shir, a professor of political science at Hebrew University, says that's not likely.
I frankly don't see this happening, even though the Likud people are working very hard to get these defectors. But since it was a very ideological election, I don't see clear defectors from these parties, and I don't think that should the Likud possible coalition be shy of 61 votes, they will succeed in pulling those mandates towards them.
Another option is a national unity government between Mr. Netanyahu's Likud and Gantz's blue and white. But given the mudslinging of the latest campaign, that also seems unlikely. For now, Israelis are exactly where they were before the election, in a political deadlock. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
And you're listening to VOA Asia.
After you listen to VOA Asia, you can see VOA Asia. VOA Asia is on YouTube. See and share the fun with Food Bites, our weekly culinary dive into foods from the homeland. Recipes that came with chefs who immigrated to the United States. Students enrolling in U.S. schools can get their first lessons about life on campus. Subscribe for free. See us often at VOA Asia YouTube.
This news alert from VOA Asia, pet cats and dogs cannot pass the virus on to humans, but they can test positive for low levels of the pathogen if they catch it from their owners. That's the conclusion of Hong Kong's Agriculture, Fisheries and Conservation Department after a dog in quarantine tested weakly positive for the virus on February 27th.
This is Science in a Minute.
A team of scientists from the U.S., Australia, and New Zealand say they have discovered remnants of the biggest explosion in the universe since the Big Bang nearly 14 billion years ago. Using data from space and ground-based observatories, the researchers say the massive explosion was found in the Ophiuchus Galaxy Supercluster, located about 390 million light-years from Earth. One of the scientists says the explosion happened very slowly and took place over hundreds of millions of years. The researchers say there is a supermassive black hole in one of the supercluster's galaxies and that they think it was what set off the record-setting explosion. The lead author of a study detailing the discovery says that you could fit 15 Milky Way galaxies in a row inside the crater the explosion created in the galaxy cluster's field of hot gas. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This news break from VOA Asia. For weeks, the world's second most populous country, India, stayed alert but hopeful that it escaped the worst of the coronavirus outbreak. Only three cases had been detected in a southern state. That optimism was shattered when the number of cases jumped this week to 29, including 16 Italian tourists. This is VOA Asia. Billionaire Mike Bloomberg's decision to drop out of the Democratic presidential race has brought to an end one of the shortest, most expensive political bids in history. Michelle Quinn takes a look at what the Bloomberg campaign was really all about.
Today, our campaign today for the presidency ends. But our campaign for a better America, a stronger America, a more just America, a more equal America, and a more united America continues. And together, we will get it done. Thank you.
Mike Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York City, spent more than $500 million of his own money on his failed bid to become the Democratic presidential nominee. After a drubbing in Super Tuesday primaries, Bloomberg left the race Wednesday and threw his support behind former Vice President Joe Biden. It was an abrupt end to a political science experiment, says Joe Garofoli, a senior political writer at the San Francisco Chronicle.
He skipped the first four contests, which are usually very seminal in shaping the course of a candidate's life in the race. And so he decided, I'm going to concentrate on Super Tuesday, where there were 14 states holding contests. He invested $500 million in those states, and he won none of them. As of right now, he only has one second place showing in the states. So it was a phenomenal disaster.
Bloomberg did have some successes, quickly building a national organization and winning endorsements. One of them was Javan Shushi, founder of the Indo-American Community Federation in Fremont, California, who reacted to the news that Bloomberg had dropped out.
I was very disheartened, but at the same time, I felt that that he knows what he's doing and he made a decision. He's one of those people who puts his country above everything else.
At first, Bloomberg seemed unstoppable, being seen over and over again in glowing television ads. And then he stumbled on the debate stage.
Bloomberg's poll numbers went down as soon as voters saw the real person as opposed to the advertisement. The candidate didn't match the campaign.
In the past few days, Biden's campaign picked up steam after a dominating win in South Carolina's primary. After that, former rivals Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg dropped out of the race and endorsed Biden.
Mike Bloomberg, like many, many before him, has proven that just because you have the most money doesn't mean you're going to be the winner. That's an important lesson to take away from Mike Bloomberg's campaign. Money is not everything.
Bloomberg supporter Soham Bhatia, who works at an educational nonprofit in Oakland, still gives him credit.
He gambled. He did something very interesting. I think he should be commended for that.
It was a gamble that won't make Bloomberg president of the United States, but it may be remembered for years to come. Michelle Quinn, VOA News, Oakland, California.
Finally, its doomed maiden voyage happened more than a century ago, but the sinking of the Titanic in 1912 remains the stuff of popular culture and the object of deep-sea salvage. A firm has recovered more than 5,000 artifacts from the ship, but as VOA's Arash Arabsadi reports, time may be running out to raise the ship's holy grail.
On the floor of the North Atlantic Ocean rusts one of history's most fantastic failures, the unsinkable RMS Titanic. The salvage firm RMS Titanic Incorporated has so far recovered more than 5,000 pieces of dinnerware and coins from the wreckage. They say after all these years underwater, time is running out to dredge the Marconi wireless telegraph machine that transmitted the Titanic's frantic distress calls. RMS Titanic Incorporated's president, Breton Hunchak.
The roof has degraded significantly, and the wreck is essentially collapsing in upon itself. So we're at a point where the Marconi is really in a detrimental area where we believe in a short period of time it will fall in upon itself, leaving the Marconi sort of to be lost to the seafloor.
At the time, the Titanic was the world's biggest ship. The luxury ocean liner set sail from London to New York, but struck an iceberg on April 14, 1912. The ship sent distress signals in Morse code using the relatively new Marconi wireless telegraph. Less than 3 hours later, it sank. Only 700 of the more than 2,000 people on board survived.
The Marconi is sort of, I believe, this generation's next step. And I believe that bringing a tangible part of Titanic to the masses, as opposed to just the few people that get to go see it, really makes that story real for them. It's a human interest piece. It's an incredible piece of technology, especially for its day. And it's the reason that I think the legacy of Titanic still exists in the strength that it does.
But outside of the Titanic Belfast Museum, not everyone shares Hunchak's quest to raise the Titanic or even parts of it, fearing the stress of extraction on the sunken ship. Parliamentarian Gavin Robinson.
We will learn nothing new. There are other Marconi radios just exactly the same that are present in other museums and available throughout the world. You can learn and understand without the need to go in and wreck and destroy.
Engineers built Titanic and its tender, the SS Nomadic, in Belfast. Today, a battle wages in the United States where the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration argues in court that the retrieval run goes against previous court orders prohibiting the removal of anything from the ship itself. Arash Arabsadi, VOA News, Washington.
And that is VOA Asia for today and for this week. Thank you so much for being it with us. We will be back again next week. We hope you will as well. And until then, be well.